Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. For more than 100 days now, Americans have been grappling with life forever altered by a global pandemic. The public health crisis is unfolding parallel to civil unrest and a presidential election, and much of our discourse during this time is occurring online. The Knight Foundation and Gallup have released a new survey called Free Expression, Harmful Speech, and Censorship in a Digital World. The survey highlights how Americans feel about free speech, online harassment, and the digital public square right now. Joseph Bottom is director of the Classics Institute at Dakota State University in Madison, and he joins us to look at the report and talk about how we feel about that digital public square right now. Dr. Bottom, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with, surveys are always useful in some ways and not in others, but we've been talking about how people sort of feel about their privacy and about the prevalence of fake misleading and misinforming Facebook posts or social media posts for some time. Does the idea that Americans don't trust tech companies to monitor their online content surprising to you? What does it say about who we are right now?
Well, this study from the Knight Foundation is so peculiar. I have trouble drawing any big conclusions from it because the data seems to run in every different direction all at once. And yet, some of it comports with our sense of things. And 84% of Americans, according to this survey, do not trust tech companies at all or very much to regulate the content on their sites. And yet, Lori, 54% of Americans, according to the same study, say that they would prefer that the tech companies do the regulating instead of the government. Which means if 84% don't trust the tech companies, an even larger percentage has to not trust the government.
Right.
And this is kind of an extraordinary conclusion. The level
of 84. Let's go through those numbers again because I just got twisted in my mind. 84% say they don't trust the tech companies, and what percent say they don't want the government to?
And yet, 54% say they would prefer that the tech companies do the regulating instead of the government.
Sure. Okay. I see. Got it.
So, this means, it's hard to draw strong conclusions from it. But what's written through this report is a profound level of American mistrust. They mistrust
right.
experts. They mistrust these large tech corporations. They mistrust the government. And they mistrust each other. 31% of Americans, according to this study, have asked for a post online to be taken down. Now, I have trouble believing that statistic, that almost a third of Americans have requested that a post be taken down, have requested a tech company to take a post down. But, it's what the data says, and that's an extraordinary number. A third of us are that involved in online life that we would request that a post be taken down.
There was a report, I can't remember. I think it was on Hidden Brain or a podcast similar to that where they were talking about what kinds of posts people request to be taken down, and sometimes they were just bad pictures of themselves. I don't like the way I look in that, or I'm embarrassed that I was at that Thanksgiving dinner. And so the tech companies were struggling with how exactly do we respond to that. So yeah, in the survey it says that, but it doesn't say what you asked to have it taken down for. It could have been just because you didn't. Your eyes were closed.
Content.
Yeah.
They say for offensive content, but offensive here is a term of art. I've been offended by the way I looked after Thanksgiving dinner. But yet, Lori, I think, you're right to zero in on this study because it really implicates our thoughts about free speech in the context of the coronavirus, the lockdowns, the social agitation over the last couple weeks, and the impending election. And, you know, what are we to make of free speech at this time? And what are we to make of free speech in the wake of the computer revolution? You know, we're now 40 years into the computer revolution. We're 20 years into the internet portion of the computer revolution. And this is, you know, one of the results is we have this data which seems to point in every direction. We have profound levels of mistrust, and we have a situation which is pretty much unbearable. I mean, social media right now is a toxic sink. And, you know, the best thing we could do is firebomb it all and start over. But, you know, since we're not going to be able to do that, we have to live with the consequences of needing reform at a time in which apparently no one in America trusts anyone to undertake that reform.
If there is so much distrust, why are so many people still using the services? And you see this all the time on Facebook when your friends say, I have to stay away from this because it's toxic or it's so negative, or, hey, let's flood Facebook or this platform with positive images because it's so gross. And then they come back quickly and say, I tried to stay off, but I couldn't. Why have we become so quick to say this is absolutely essential to our lives, but we also hate it?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating development, and it is the fruit of the computer revolution, of course. But the benefits and the disadvantages are inseparable. We can't apparently have a system in which everybody gets to post cat videos and charming pictures of little baby animals and not have people try and take advantage of it. Plus, you know, people are worked up about politics, people are worked up about social issues, and one's ability to separate those has gradually decayed. And, you know, we have ads pushed on us. I took Lent this year, or one of my Lenten disciplines this year was I got off social media for Lent. No tweets, no Facebook. And one of the things I discovered is when I went back after Easter, the first things to pop up in my Facebook feed were political advertisements. So it becomes inescapable. The money-making models of these internet companies depend on, you know, agitation. I think maybe one way to think of it, Lori, is to use a phrase from the great sociologist Max Weber, who borrowed a term from early chemistry called elective affinities. And we have this sense, he had this sense that in the beginning of the modern age, there were all these trends. There was a rise of feeling for democracy. There was the Protestant Reformation. There was the scientific revolution. All these things were going on in the early decades of the birth of the modern age. And they didn't logically go together. There was nothing in the Protestant Reformation, for instance, that demanded the scientific revolution. There was nothing in the scientific revolution that demanded the rise of democracy or the rise of the nation state or all these other trends that were going on in early modernity. And yet somehow, despite the fact that they didn't have logical demands for each other, they all pointed in the same direction. They all pushed us into the modern age. That's a useful kind of analysis to think here. We have a whole bunch of different things going on, and they don't necessarily relate to one another. They don't logically demand one another. We could have the internet with a bunch of old-fashioned 1950s-style manners, but somehow everything that's going on is pushing us in the same direction towards this toxicity and this vileness of our public discourse. We have, you know, the joy that people feel in the power of what they call cancel culture, this ability to kind of isolate a subject online and devastate that person. There was an article in USA Today, an opinion column in USA Today this morning, about a young woman who a 17-minute or 17-second video of her putting up plywood over windows in Los Angeles and Santa Monica became an internet meme and destroyed her. She lost her internship. She was accused of being a prostitute for Instagram followers, just sort of devastating over this 17-second video that did nothing but show her with a drill putting up plywood. And this joy in this cancel culture is pushing us. The conservative sense of needing to be tough on crime is pushing in the same direction. The social justice warriors and racial agitation is pushing us. The new definitions of sexual harassment, the remnants of old, you know, manners that said we shouldn't have foul language and nudity in public is pushing us. The decline of newspaper revenues and the need thus for constantly escalating scandal is pushing us. And all of this, none of these elements necessarily go together. They don't logically demand one another. And yet somehow the result of the mix of them, their elective affinity for each other, is pushing us ever further down this slope of vileness.
Americans want open expression. We value the First Amendment. That seems to be a pretty standard. But they also are interested in this notion of responsibility and even liability. What can we say right now about... And we should say in this report, you know, 98% of Americans say child pornography should never be allowed on social media. That's the thing we agree on the most, is that child porn is still a no-no. 85% say misleading health information. What? Yes. Like, phew, thank goodness. we've still agreed on that social norm. 85% say misleading health information should also be prohibited. So there's a lot happening here. In one sense, we're thinking like it's just toxic and it's negative. In one sense, we have this awareness of the divisiveness, that the sort of algorithm trying to get us to spend more time and keep our eyeballs fixated longer is destructive. But then we're also saying, you know, we don't want false. I mean, we trusted newspapers. We trusted, you know, Walter Cronkite's name keeps coming up in my social circle for some reason. There was a time that people think that they trusted something and some voice, and they still want their information to be true. But who's responsible for making it true if it is a platform for simply providing it? It's not. Facebook isn't a newspaper. Facebook isn't a publisher.
Well, legally, they're not. And I think much good came from the Digital Millennium Act, which is what Section 230 sets up as saying public or, you know, these internet companies are not legally responsible for the posts that third parties put on them. So Facebook can't be sued when Lori Walsh puts something on her Facebook page that someone objects to. You can be sued, but Facebook cannot. Facebook has a safe harbor. And that's what Section 230 did. And much good came of it. But, you know, there are no unalloyed goods in human life. Excuse me. And much bad has come from it, too.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Dr. Joseph Bottom with Dakota State University. He's director of the Classics Institute at DSU and teaches and writes extensively on ethics in the digital age. And we're talking about this new report, a new survey and a report from the Knight Foundation in conjunction with Gallup about free speech and harmful speech and censorship in a digital world. Joseph, are the tech companies part of the solution right now? Do they feel, let's talk a little bit about what people think might be some options for changing things and making them better. Do we feel helpless right now, or do we feel like there are choices?
Well, the Knight Foundation study, this Knight Gallup study, suggests at the end that there might be some support for content boards, you know, for an independent content board appointed by Twitter, for instance, to look over these requests for censorship and removal of tweets. And there might be some support from that, but, you know, the level of mistrust is so profound that it's not at all clear to me that we could trust anyone. It's interestingly, the people slightly more in favor of some social, of some censorship, are Democrats, but the people most mistrustful of the content boards are Republicans. I think they have a sense that these social media companies are dominated by their political opponents, and that if that these ostensibly independent boards would be enforcing the rules much more strongly against conservatives than they would be enforcing them against liberals. What all of that is a general mistrust that there are any truly independent, neutral actors that you could put on this kind of board. And I think, Lori, it does come down to free speech and what we think about that. You know, a good majority, I think it's 65% of people in this study support free speech, support the First Amendment, and the kind of broad maximal interpretation of the First Amendment that we've given since the 1950s, that the courts have been giving us since the 1950s. 65% of Americans say they support that. But if you drill down into the data, you see that it's much higher percentage among older people than it is among younger people, which suggests that there's a kind of fragility about our support for free speech. One of the items, for instance, that a good majority of Americans agreed should be banned is hate speech. But the courts have consistently held that hate speech is as protected as any other kind of speech. So already there, we're seeing some kind of dissatisfaction with free speech. Now, in a kind of philosophical analysis of ethics, that would suggest that free speech and the First Amendment is a totem. We say we believe in it. We nod judiciously toward it. We wave at it and say, yes, we believe in it. But when it comes down to particularities and practicalities, we're actually losing our belief in it. And that, you know, that's what makes these kind of taboos or totems fragile, is suddenly everybody wakes up and says, well, why are we saying we believe in that when we don't? And I suspect there's a certain truth to that, that the condition of support for free speech is much weaker than this, you know, the flat question, do you support free speech, suggests in the study. I think actually, you know, we could see free speech go away, at least this kind of maximal interpretation of free speech. At the same time, I wonder, maybe Americans are supporting free speech, the idea of free speech, precisely because this study suggests they don't trust anybody. I mean, that we should allow free speech because we don't trust anyone to be the regulator of speech. It's not that we like free speech particularly, but that we think, you know, it's an awful road to go down. Once you start letting somebody regulate speech, people are going to try and game that system, and the regulators are going to be under a lot of pressure to pick sides in politics, to pick sides in policy issues, to pick sides in scientific debates, often for political reasons. There's going to be a lot of pressure on them. We don't trust the tech companies to do this, and we trust the government even less to do this. So that maybe free speech is strongly supported. Maybe I'm wrong that it's just a totem that's in decay. Maybe we really do support free speech precisely because we recognize in this massive mistrust, we recognize that there's sort of no one qualified to limit anyone else's speech. And if that's true, that's pretty much what the founders had in mind in the First Amendment.
I was just going to say that takes us back to the beginning, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, this is we don't hold free speech as some kind of ideal for the ages. We hold free speech because we know that we live in a world with human beings who are drawn to scandal, who are prone to gossip, who love this kind of excitement of watching someone get taken down, and who are filled with, an apparent hunger for rumors and conspiracy theories. And if we live in that world, which is the world we actually do live in, Lori, this world of human beings, then we need rights that will protect us from this inability of anyone to be the philosopher king, to be the abstract and purely neutral judge of things. And that was the founders' view, right? We have a government of men, not of angels.
Let me ask this question, and it's about misleading health information, especially during a pandemic. There seems to be a distinction between, free political speech and or even hate speech and something that, circulates that is a false, that is selling snake oil, that we have a sense that should be regulated in a way. And people are saying these tech companies are not good at catching the snake oil salesman.
They are not, but it's not clear who is. I mean, one of the reasons for our mistrust is these claims about medical stuff rely on the idea that there is a neutral thing out there, which is scientific medicine, and that its spokespeople are above or outside the political fray. They're outside the conditions of social agitation. They are merely reporting the truth. And, Americans don't entirely believe that. Now, we were just informed that we were openly lied to about face masks, that one of the reasons that the medical community was in the early days of the coronavirus saying face masks do not do any good was because they were worried about the supply of face masks for medical personnel. And they thought if everybody rushed out and bought face masks, they wouldn't have enough for the medical personnel, and that would worsen the epidemic. Now, that's, maybe that's a good motive, but it still means that we were, by the people who claim that they are neutral arbiters of the truth about medicine, we were lied to. So why should we trust them in other stuff? Well, we should trust them in other stuff because there is actually this thing called medicine that has some independence from the political fray. But, even the medical and scientific stuff is human beings who are speaking in political and social contexts. And, they're opposed to Trump so that they'll attack anything that he says, or they're opposed to Joe Biden so they'll attack anything he says. This idea that we really have the kind of neutrality we need to achieve what I think is an admirable goal, which is banning snake oil or snake oil salesmen, the idea that we have the independent expertise to be able to do that is not at all clear, to me at least, Lori.
Yeah. Is there a sense that if the the fundamental mission of keeping eyeballs glued to, your social media platform for longer, if that could be adjusted somehow, if those algorithms and the way that these platforms are designed, do Americans have a sense, or do you have a sense that would change things? Because that divisive content gets a lot of clicks. A screaming headline gets a lot more views than, a scientific study, for example. Are people looking for a quieter social media experience in that sense, or not at all?
Oh, I think they're looking, but, there was an article a couple years ago, or a little bit of news reporting, about the largest knitting group on Reddit. This is a group of people who knit, right? And And they tell each other stories about their knitting projects and the scarves they knitted for their cats and, you know, how to knit one and purl two and all the rest of the knitting stuff. And they share patterns with each other. Somebody made a joke about a political figure in the course of this. You know, I wanted to make faces of presidents, but I couldn't bring myself to include Trump or something like that. And the largest collection of online knitters blew up. They ended up banning half the members. They were filled with recuperation. You know, the politics in this way sneaks into everything. Now, what we need are manners, because law is simply too blunt an instrument to achieve the kind of thing that you're looking for, Lori, this kind of social media or online experience that isn't susceptible to profanity and nudity and political fervor and social agitation. We just, you know, we want a kinder, gentler, simpler way to have our family follow our pictures of the baby behaving cutely, and that's not susceptible to this. Well, law is, which is always the thing we look to first, is a very blunt instrument. It's not going to achieve what we want. It can either destroy this online experience, or it can leave it alone. There's nothing between. What we need are manners, but we're in the odd spot of trying to recreate manners in an age that had gotten rid of manners in this old sense, and the idea that you don't discuss politics or religion at the dinner table. That's an old-fashioned kind of manners thing. But, you know, we don't have it anymore. In fact, we're told to, by some political campaigns over the past decade, precisely to discuss politics and social issues at Thanksgiving dinner. So, you know, the old manner system collapsed, and we're in this strange situation of trying to rebuild it kind of like a cargo cult. We're trying to, you know, recreate it in ways that show we really lost it. But manners are going to emerge. They have to. There has to be a kind of way of saying, take your politics out of here. Take your social agitation out of here. Take your profanity and pictures of nudity out of here. We just want to have civil discussions of interesting topics. I think the general purpose media platforms like Facebook and Twitter are ultimately going to fail at that. But there are narrower versions where you can, or narrower possibilities. And I think those are what we're going to have to see emerge at some point. But in the meanwhile, we have a very toxic situation, and it aggravates everything, and everything pushes it forward. The coronavirus lockdown pushed a whole bunch more people online because they were working from home. They were working at their computers all day. And this is what I meant by everything pushes in the same direction, even though there's no logical connection between them or among them. Yeah. And we're pushed ever more into an online experience. And it's an online experience that's really quite poisonous.
We are going to have to leave this conversation there for now. We hope to have you back in the future. Dr. Joseph Bottom is director of the Classics Institute at Dakota State University in Madison. Thanks so much for being here again. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.